the Moan Broadcast Center. This is Take 2. Me, Martinez. Saddle Ridge Fire in the North San Fernando Valley is chewing up Sylmar, Porter Ranch, and Newhall. It started last night, but the Santa Ana winds have made it tough for firefighters to tame. More than 7,500 acres burned, 13% containment so far. We're going to hear from our KPCC reporters who have been covering the Saddle Ridge Fire. That and a lot more kicks off when Take 2 begins in just a few minutes. Keep your ears here. From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take 2. I'm Martinez. You know, the big mission of this show is to inform you about what's going on in your neighborhood and with your neighbors. And today is going to be one of those days where we're going to spend the entire time that we have with you today doing exactly that. And the reason is because up and down California, the state is really just being chewed up by as many as 10 wildfires going on right now. And the reality of the price we sometimes have to pay for living here is hitting us yet again. Thursday, the Sandalwood Fire tore through a mobile home park in Cali Mesa in Riverside County, taking the life of 89-year-old Lois Arvixen and destroying 74 homes. It is now 10% contained. Two other smaller fires are also burning nearby. Then last night, the Saddle Ridge Fire in North San Fernando Valley erupted. Kenny Ahn is in Porter Ranch up there and told us this.
We evacuated around about 2 in the morning. We went to sleep, and then we woke up to a lot of smell, a smoke smell, and a lot of friends calling and leaving us messages and waking us up, thankfully. But, you know, it's always one of those things where you think, it's not my house, it's not where I am. Hopefully it'll be okay, and it'll get better over time.
It is this fire in particular that hits really close to my heart. In the early 1990s, my mom and dad bought a home in Granada Hills, right near the entrance to O'Melveny Park. That's a place where I used to trail run through pretty much each and every single day. Now, if you knew your way around, you could run there to the hills behind Porter Ranch, almost like you were moving parallel to Rinaldi Street and the 118 freeway. Back then, Rinaldi ended really right at Tampa Avenue. There were a few spots being developed in the area just north of that, a few homes being built here and there, but plenty of open space with a breeze going 24/7. It was a kind of place where you would go if you were 20 years old, had a six-pack of beer, and just wanted to hang out without being worried about the cops finding you. Well, these days, there's a lot more there. A lot of homes, retail stores, restaurants. The Saddle Ridge Fire, that one started in Sylmar, north of the 210 freeway, right around 9 at night. It got a big push from the Santa Ana winds to spread into the area that I just described, Porter Ranch. As of right now, 7,500 acres have burned, around 800 acres per hour, 25 structures burned, thousands have been evacuated, freeways are closed. It's now 13% contained, and I've been texting my mom, my dad, my brother, because the map I'm constantly refreshing all day long has their house, the one I described in Granada Hills, right on the edge of the mandatory evacuation zone. But as of now, they say that while the ground is ashy, the air is smoky, that they're doing okay. I'm hoping they're prepared to leave if they have to. If it were up to me, my mom, dad, and my brother would be sitting in my house in Burbank. Now, KPCC Sharon McNary is also out there as well. She joins us now for an update. Sharon, welcome.
Hey there. I'm sorry to hear that your parents are like stuck in the middle of that. But, I mean, that's just part of being a Southern Californian, isn't it? At some point, there's going to be a fire near you.
Yeah, it is. And as I mentioned earlier too, Sharon, it's the price that we seem to pay for living here in Southern California. Now,
pay.
Yeah, yeah. And so they're telling me that it's smoky and ashy. What are you seeing up there?
Well, what's interesting is that the place I'm at, which is the Hanson Dam Recreation Area, which is the command center for the fire, the sky is blue, the air is clear, nobody's wearing their masks. But if you go over the ridge toward where the fire is, that's where it gets all very smoky. The other thing is, since the fire is kind of like moving, the fire wants to move uphill in a northerly direction, but the winds are kind of coming from the north toward the south. So the fire is kind of creeping north that way. So it's kind of tending to kind of cancel itself out.
And Sharon, I'm taking a look at the TV. We have our media partner, NBC4, up. It's right where Newhall is, near the 5 freeway and the 14 freeway. Just gigantic, massive clouds of smoke just going all the way up into the sky. It looks awful from where I'm sitting right here. When it comes to areas being evacuated, what areas are being evacuated? What areas still maybe are being monitored?
Okay, so I don't have the specific neighborhoods, but I did have a fire deputy chief walk me through the fire map that you might have seen on display during the press conference. So that area of Sylmar toward the east of the fire zone, that's where the 13% containment line is, so the easternmost piece of the fire. Toward the west, that Granada Hills, that Porter Ranch, that other Mission Hills, that's the area that's still evacuated. I haven't heard that they're enlarging the evacuation area at this point. I think their biggest concern is if the wind shifts and pushes that fire like over the hill into Santa Clarita, that could be a problem. There's a lot of oil operations, you know, west of the 14. And then they're also telling people in Ventura County, be alert. Do not be complacent about how this fire could move. You know that they extended the red flag alert for another, I think it was another 12 hours at least. So it's going to be still going on tomorrow morning.
This fire erupted very quickly after most people had fallen asleep, and it was moving fast thanks to the sand and winds. How would you say the communication has been so far around this fire?
Well, you know, social media can help us and it can also hurt us. I did ask that specific question at the press conference about the confusion expressed by some people about where they should go, where's the evacuation center. And what the councilwoman, Monica Rodriguez, said is that a lot of people are getting misinformation, perhaps well meant, from places like Nextdoor.com or, you know, their little social media groups. She says, do the official app online, which is, I'm losing the track of it right now. She's saying text the word ready to the number, I think it's 777-888. So I don't want to say it wrong. You guys can double check for me. But there is a place where you can get formal, you know, verified alerts as to evacuation areas. So people might be conflating the chit chat on their local social media with something that's official, and that can create misunderstanding.
888-777. That's what I've been told.
Thank you.
Yeah, there you go. And Sharon, one more thing, really quick. We're hearing a lot of wind behind you. Is it very breezy where you're at right now?
Not where I am. It's just my phone.
Okay.
I need a new phone. Tell IT I need a new phone.
Okay, we'll tell them that right away. Sharon McNary, KPCC's infrastructure reporter, out reporting on the Saddle Ridge Fire in the North San Fernando Valley. Sharon, thanks a lot.
You bet.
For many residents in the Sylmar area, this is not a new experience. Back in 2008, the Sayre Fire burned 11,000 acres, destroyed nearly 500 homes. In 2018, the Woolsey Fire raged nearby, prompting the evacuation of 295,000 people, destroying over 1,500 structures. Three people died in that one. Today, the Saddle Ridge Fire has swelled to more than 7,500 acres, 13% contained. Now, to find out why this area is so prone to wildfire, we have Amelie Orme. She's a professor of geography and environmental studies at Cal State University Northridge. Amelie, welcome back to Take Two.
Thank you very much, Hug.
You live in Woodland Hills, about 8 miles from the Saddle Ridge Fire. Not too close, but also not very far either. Is the fire affecting your area at all?
Well, about the only outcome that we have is a lot of ash just coming down in the sky filled with smoke. But we are pretty clear right now.
Now, up top, I mentioned how a few of the fires that affected the Sylmar area happened just in the last few years. But can you give us a few more details on its history with fire?
Sure. We might remember also that in 2017, the Creek Fire, which started in Cagle Canyon, which is roughly to the east of the current fire, was also part of this broader pattern of expanding fires in California. And the thing that we have to bear in mind is that at this time of year, there is a major shift in weather patterns in which cold air moves down from the Arctic and Arctic Canada into the Great Basin, which is to the northeast of Southern California. And this cold air settles and you create high pressure. And with high pressure over the Great Basin, air will always move from high pressure to low pressure. And therefore, the air moves from the Great Basin towards California and Southern California in particular, thus setting up the situation for these Santa Ana winds.
I mentioned how you're a professor at Cal State Northridge. I went to Cal State Northridge. My mom still lives up there in that area. One thing that you know, that if you live up there, there's always a breeze going all the time. Sometimes it's warm, sometimes it's cool, but it is always blowing. This specific location, how prone is it to wildfires when it comes to the wind and the Santa Ana winds that we're seeing now?
Well, this is considered a high-risk area, and it has historically been this, and there's topographic reasons for it. Part of it is the Santa Susana Pass, which helps to funnel the air that is moving from the northeast towards the southwest, so it makes this area particularly vulnerable.
When it comes to the ignition of these fires, how often are we the cause for it, human beings?
Well, you know, if we look at the records of California fires over the past century, they are dominated by human-set fires, and that can be directly or it can be indirectly. And we know that there's natural causes, such as lightning strikes. But particularly in the urban areas, we have been faced with a couple of factors. Carelessness, fires being lit by people who don't understand the danger. Some are directional, and others in particular, and as we saw in the recent fires in Northern California, are the result of an infrastructure that supports above-ground power lines, which in high winds, of course, are subject to falling down, to sparking, and so on.
Talking to Amelie Orm. She's a geography and environmental studies professor at Cal State University in Northridge. We're just getting notice, too, of a fire in El Sereno. It is small right now compared to some of the other fires going on in the area. It's getting close to homes. We'll keep you updated on that one as that fire moves along. Amelie, what are your thoughts when it comes to preventing wildfires in these areas? Are there any specific policies or land management practices that could help? I spoke to someone yesterday who comes from Holland, and when she showed up here to the United States, she couldn't believe all of the above ground power lines that are everywhere, because she said that in Holland you won't see them. They're all underground and they don't have to deal with the fires that we have to deal with here.
True. The way Southern California and a good deal of California was developed during the early years of the 20th century was to put everything above ground. It was convenient and it was cheap. Newer communities tend to have their facilities underground, and thus you avoid that problem. But you really have to look at the bigger picture here in terms of not just preventing wildfires, which will happen, but also the fact that we have expansion of homes, development into areas that have traditionally caught fire. And it means that you have to have very strict regulations. Now, the newer developments do have very strict clearance policies that are in place that are designed to protect people but not to prevent wildfire. So that's fireproof roofs, windows that are specially treated, mesh over all of the areas that might be a chimney or a draft area. But that doesn't prevent the wildfire. And if we were to sort of look into the future of what areas might burn in particular, we really have to look very close to the area that is burning today. You have vegetation up there that is probably 30 to 60 years in age, and that, of course, makes it very vulnerable. Secondly, we had a very wet year, and that caused a lot of growth both as understory grasses, but also, too, tree species have really bloomed and blossomed out, and that, of course, will help to contribute to crown fires and the spread of fire much more rapidly. So there's a variety of things here that where you're not going to prevent the fires, but we have to have policies in place that attempt to protect people and structures while recognizing at the same time that we have expanded into areas that are in fact corridors for wind and therefore embers and fire.
Amelie, about that rain, because I think a lot of people think that, well, when it rains a lot, that means that things stay moist. They stay somewhat wet, so they're not going to catch fire as quickly. But I mean, the conventional wisdom is that that's not the case. That just provides more fuel for the fire. Why do we think that rain is helpful when it comes to preventing fire, when in reality it probably isn't?
Well, I think when we have rain, it's a panacea for people in Southern California because everything turns green and you have a sense of safety. But in fact, when you go into the urban and rural fringe landscapes, you begin to see that there is a tremendous amount of growth that results from excessive rain. And of course, our chaparral are still recovering from the recent drought, and it's not to say that the drought is over by any means. However, you have a lot of growth, and it fools people into thinking that everything is safe. You couple that with the fact that we've had a very warm summer, and we are continuing to have very warm days, higher percentages of warm days, and very dry days. And this, of course, will help to create large rates of evapotranspiration, and therefore things dry out fairly quickly.
Amelie, one more thing really quick. If history is our guide, I mean, this is just the beginning. What areas, really quick, are on your radar as particularly fire-prone this season?
Southern California, the areas north of Castaic, the Libra Mountain areas, east of the Five, in which there's a tremendous growth of vegetation, and probably the west slope of the Sierra Nevada. Probably the Central Coast ranges also.
That's Professor Amelie Orme, Professor of Geography and Environmental Studies at Cal State University Northridge. Thank you very much for the time.
You're most welcome.
Keep it tuned right here to KPCC all day long. We're going to keep covering these fires and any other fires that spring up. More Take Two coming right up. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. Amy Martinez. Now, just an update for you right now on another fire. This one, the one I mentioned a few minutes ago, burning right now in El Sereno. It's a 20-acre grass fire. L.A. Fire Department says it's not driven by heavy winds, but some homes are threatened. We're going to keep you posted on that, as well as the Saddle Ridge fire throughout the show. In just a few minutes, we're going to be speaking with the health effects officer for the Air Quality Management District about air quality in the burn areas right now and what you can do to protect yourself if you smell smoke. So stay right here with us on 89.3 KPCC. Right now, let's look at some of the politics happening around all those fires in California with State of Affairs. That's our weekly look at politics in the Golden State. Power line shutoffs to the north have left millions without electricity. We're going to hear what lawmakers have said about that with Carla Marinucci, senior editor for Politico's California Playbook. Welcome back, Carla.
Hey, good to be with you, Abe.
Also, Zach Corser is with us. He co-directs the Policy Lab at Claremont McKenna College. Welcome back to you as well, Zach.
Hi, Carla. Great to be back.
All right, Carla, let's start with you. Pacific Gas and Electric has been behind those shutoffs to the north. As of now, 312,000 of their customers without power. I understand you were affected by these outages as well. What have lawmakers been saying about PG&E and their shutoffs?
Well, you know, this was a rare case where you had Republican conservatives like Representative Tom McClintock and liberal Democrats like State Senator Scott Wiener on the same page. They were representing their anger, their outrage. Representative Ro Khanna tweeted that PG&E has paid out millions in bonuses and couldn't find the time or energy to spend on wildfire prevention. So that kind of outrage is what Governor Gavin Newsom said. Look, California consumers should be feeling. He was out there with that message this week. And, the outrage was there. Yes, I was affected. I was filing my stories at 4 a.m. from a floor of a 24-hour fitness because I didn't have the power in Oakland. And I think you multiply that by that kind of frustration by 2.2 million consumers, and you get a picture of the possible political fallout for Gavin Newsom and the legislators in Sacramento.
And Carla, really quick, I mean, that's part of this whole thing, right? Aside from some of the health dangers, people that need medication, that needs to be refrigerated, that if they don't have power might be lacking, the lack of productivity for a lot of people that have to work without power, that is also a big drain.
That's right. The estimates were California could take a $2 billion hit because of the economic impacts. And we just got, as we're going on the air, the first headline of a man who actually died because his medical device went off about 12 minutes into a power outage. So there were big human costs. Gavin Newsom seemed to be aware of that. But boy, the potential for blowback in Sacramento is huge.
Zach, I should mention that here in Southern California, more than 20,000 SoCal Edison customers currently without power in five counties. Governor Newsom's one-time Republican challenger, John Cox, has weighed in on the shutoffs, tweeting, "Happy birthday, Gavin Newsom. Your third world state has people living on the streets, millions without power, underperforming schools, massive underfunded pensions, rationed water, and businesses fleeing. Time for you to troll D.C. to distract attention." End quote. That was from John Cox. How good of a job, Zach, has Gavin Newsom done controlling the message on this?
Well, look, keeping the lights on is a kind of bedrock assumption that'll bring both parties together against you. And so I think Newsom's got to sort of get ahead of this message and show some leadership on this question. It's not an easy question in the sense that, you know, PG&E, I think, is taking a tack here where they're saying, look, we almost went bankrupt over a fire, and we are just not willing to assume this risk anymore. And there's some, you know, Senator Wiener and others are saying, wait a second, guys, you are not tailoring these to for safety. You're actually just cutting off broad swaths of California without cause. Newsom's got to get in between both sides of this and find a solution and be more proactive. There was a lot of reaction to what to do about PG&E in terms of finding responsibility for the campfire, in terms of trying to find a way forward to where they would not go bankrupt. But climate change is a reality, as you were talking about in the last segment, and risk, it continues to rise. And I think Newsom's got to show some leadership and come up with a plan that demonstrates that not only he understands the problem, but has some solutions and is ready to fix it.
And Zach, it sounds like there was going to be maybe no smooth way to do this. I mean, like you mentioned, climate change is a problem that we all have to kind of face up to. And it's happening, I think, a lot quicker than anyone expected.
I think that's right. And I don't know that it's realistic in the short term to assume that PG&E is going to have the ability, because they're so far behind financially right now, to do things like, for example, fireproof the electrical networks in California by putting them underground. That's very costly. I think they also, in terms of a business plan, need some way in which they can effectively control for risk. And I don't think the legislature or the governor's office are quite willing to take that responsibility on themselves. And so this, I don't see a solution to this if we don't come to terms with the fact that there's some very expensive, difficult changes to California's climate that are going to need some commensurate, expensive, leadership type solutions to solve them.
And Carl, you mentioned how when it comes to power shutoffs, that's something that Republicans and Democrats both can agree on and both can equally hate. How do you think Gavin Newsom has handled the criticism lobbed his way? Because Doug LaMalfa has piled on PG&E and Gavin Newsom.
Well, you know, we have to remember that this day came down in a week in which Newsom had hundreds of bills on his desk. They have to be signed by Sunday. There was that. But on the other hand, if you're sitting there with lights off, you don't care. You just want the lights back on. And I think there's some evidence that, you know, folks in Sacramento, including Newsom, in the beginning of the week were not getting how this was playing out for real people who are about to sit there in the dark. I was at an event in Oakland this week, just lights hours before these lights were about to go out. And Newsom was there with all these legislators. They were going to sign housing bills. And the big, huge press corps on hand did not want to talk about housing bills. They were all going to pummel Newsom with questions on the outage. You had bureaucrats at Caltrans suggesting this was going to be the new normal for California. And you could hear the cries of, oh, no, it's not, from a lot of consumers. I think Newsom got that message yesterday because he gave sort of a damage control press conference. He just blistered PG&E. He said this was not a climate change event. This was a mismanagement event. This was greed. And he said he's going to hold them accountable. So there was a lot of real tough talk from him. And he said this is not going to be the new normal. So I think we have to watch how this is going to play out. But I think that Gray Davis message got to him real fast.
I was about to mention Gray Davis because power cuts and the governor's office, so when you put those two together, if you've been following state politics for a while, that it'll lead you back to Gray Davis. That's part of the reason why he was recalled.
Yeah.
And obviously PG&E's issues predate Gavin Newsom, but Zach, is there a risk that this could take him down somehow, or take him down a notch, maybe?
Well, I think, yeah, history does teach us that issues, fundamental issues like keeping the lights on, can change people's perspectives over literally overnight. And if Newsom doesn't get ahead of this, you know, there could be some real risk ahead. I mean, it's just his first year, though. I think we shouldn't get overly excited. I think the other interesting dynamic here is, you know, you quoted John Cox earlier. You know, the real danger to Gavin Newsom politically is certainly not from the Republican Party. I think it comes from, you know, the fact that the Democratic Party, for all intents and purposes, you know, California's a one-party state, and that tends to cause some factionalizing where, you know, the overall party message starts to loosen a bit as factions of the party become stronger. And I think what could happen is that Gavin Newsom will lose control over a significant faction of his party, and that may lead to something like a recall, or at least, you know, putting him in a position where he's just weak politically. So I think it's actually kind of a complicated political picture for Newsom, but absolutely not keeping the lights on is going to cause, you know, further friction and maybe some questions about the future of his leadership.
And we mentioned State Senator Scott Wiener. He had that bill that proposed to limit shutoffs. The legislature expected to hold the bill until January. Carla, what would that bill have done, and why do you think it was not part of the flurry of wildfire bills that Governor Newsom indeed signed last week?
Yeah, you know, that's right. You know, when word that PG&E might shut off power for millions surfaced back in August, Wiener did introduce that bill that would limit blackout plans, and really come down on PG&E, stick it to PG&E for the costs. Among other things, this was a bill that was going to establish procedures for customers and for businesses to recover costs within 2 weeks of a blackout. It would have required the utility to create a fund paid for by the shareholders for that recovery, and it would have fined PG&E per hour for those blackouts. And a lot of consumers probably love that idea, but there wasn't time to get it through, and now it's on hold until early January. But a lot of people are going to be watching that one, no question.
And one more thing, just to touch on what's happening right here in the LA area, the Saddle Ridge fire. California has asked for federal assistance from FEMA. It has been granted. Carla, what does that money go toward?
Yeah, as you mentioned earlier in the broadcast, you know, we're at 7,500 acres, 13% contained, and this FEMA money is important. It's going to pay for 75% of eligible firefighting costs, and that includes things like field camps, you know, equipment use, materials, supplies, stuff that is going to be needed right here and right now to take care of the problem. So that's good news for California that those FEMA funds have come through.
Carla Marinucci, senior editor for Politico's California Playbook. Zach Corser co-directs the Policy Lab at Claremont McKenna College. Zach, Carla, thanks a lot.
Thanks,
Ed. Thanks for having me.
So just got a note from the LAPD's HQ on Twitter. 23,000 evacuation orders, all of Porter Ranch, Oak Ridge Estates, homes west of Balboa, north of Sesson to the Ventura County border. Those evacuation orders are mandatory. West of Balboa, that is my mom's, dad's, and brother's house. So I'm going to take the next few minutes while you guys take a break here to text them to make sure that they're okay. More Take Two coming right up. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. We're covering the wildfires burning throughout the area, most notably the Saddle Ridge fire burning near Sylmar. That is 13% contained. And also the Sandalwood fire out of Riverside. That one 10% contained. And if you live in these areas, you already know it's difficult to breathe, but just how bad is it? For more on how fires affect air quality and when it's a good time to start wearing a mask, we have Jo K. Gosch. She's the Health Effects Officer for the Air Quality Management District. Jo, welcome to Take Two.
Hi, thank you.
Now, two of the fires that are of most concern right now are in the Cali Mesa community of Riverside and Sylmar in the San Fernando Valley. How is air quality being affected in those areas? I'm looking at the TV screen. It looks as smoky as anything I've ever seen.
Right. We're definitely seeing some significant air quality impacts from both fires. For the fire out in Sylmar, we're seeing smoke impacts certainly throughout the San Fernando Valley, but all the way out to the coast and also up into the Santa Clarita Valley as well. And then for the fire happening in the Inland Empire, we're seeing smoke impacts in the western Riverside County area and also up into the San Bernardino Valley.
So air with wind, obviously things move around a lot. It wouldn't be just the areas where the fire is burning that air quality is poor, correct? It's got to be all over the place.
That's right. We can definitely see smoke impacts that can go pretty widespread. And we have issued a smoke advisory that really covers many of these areas as well.
Well, how large of an area and where specifically?
So right now, our smoke advisory is covering the coastal, northwest coastal area of L.A. County, the San Fernando Valley, Santa Clarita Valley, and the portions of the San Gabriel Mountains. And then for the Inland Empire, we're looking at Metropolitan Riverside County, Paris Valley, Hemet San Jacinto, and San Gorgonio Pass, as well as the San Bernardino Valley.
Now, it's Friday, so I know a lot of high school football games were scheduled today. Some of them have been canceled. And I would assume, obviously, Joe, that people, if they don't have to be outside doing anything strenuous, probably shouldn't.
That's right. The general recommendation is that if you smell smoke or if you're seeing ash due to the wildfire, you should try to remain indoors with your doors and windows closed, or you can seek alternate shelter. Definitely try to avoid physical activity, physical exertion, and any outdoor activities.
What other precautions should people take to make sure they're not breathing air that's dangerous? I mean, or at this point today, right now, Joe, is everything you could possibly breathe everywhere dangerous or at least somewhat threatening?
I mean, certainly when you're at in places where you're smelling smoke,
yeah.
That's a pretty good indication that your particulate matter air pollution levels are elevated. And so I think, you know, it's a general precaution to try to just minimize how much of that you're breathing. We understand sometimes people, you know, must be outdoors for certain reasons, but in general, try to minimize that time spent outdoors.
You mentioned particulate matter in the air. What types of masks are most effective when wildfires are burning? Some people go out and buy simple painter's mask or the mask a doctor would wear in a hospital, but it doesn't sound like or seem like that would be enough.
Right. In general, dust masks or surgical masks really don't offer hardly any protection at all when it comes to this kind of smoke, because the particles are so small that they can really kind of get past the mask. If someone is looking for a mask that can at least offer some protection, there are masks that are labeled with N95 or P100, and these are considered respirators, disposable respirators, that can offer some limited protection if they are worn properly and have a tight fit.
And say if you're indoors and you're not sure if there's filters anywhere, should you just wear the mask inside as well?
I think that is a decision that's up to the user. I think in general, if you are indoors and you have, say, a central air conditioning system, you can run the air conditioning to try to help filter out some particles. Just make sure your filter is clean.
Joe Kagosh, Health Effects Officer for the Air Quality Management District. Joe, thanks a lot for taking the time.
Thanks for having me.
And if you'd like to learn more about what face masks are most effective, check out the Take Two Facebook page and also our sister website, LAIST, that's LAIST.com. As we've been talking about, this is not the first time the area near Sylmar has burned. Just a couple of years ago, the Creek Fire destroyed 123 structures, including 60 homes. Before that, Sayre Fire in 2008 destroyed 489 residences, mostly mobile homes in the Oak Ridge Mobile Home Park. And this area is not alone in being hit by wildfires again and again. Wildfire is now expected norm each fall, especially for certain communities that butt up against the hillsides and also the neighboring wilderness. Yet people still live in these areas, and they even build more homes in these areas. Here to talk about why and what can be done to mitigate the risk, we've got KPCC environment reporter Emily Guerin. Hey, Emily.
Hi, A.
In Southern California, a lot of communities in areas that face a heightened risk of wildfire, what do these places all have in common?
Well, I think, like you said, A, they're often very desirable places to live because they are right on the edge of undeveloped lands, you know, wild lands. It's sort of ironic that the most sort of beautiful remote areas are often the most dangerous areas. And scientists have a really wonky term for those areas, the wildland-urban interface. And it just means the areas where neighborhoods butt up against undeveloped land.
It's kind of like the promise of the West, right? That you'd have open space to stretch out and just be you in
yeah,
a way.
Exactly.
Yeah. Now, for the people who live in these areas, when fires do occur, what are the biggest risks residents face?
Well, so in terms of why houses do catch on fire in these areas, what we know is that it's not like flames coming right up to your house and igniting, you know, something in your yard. It's embers that are blowing from pretty far away. I'm sure we've heard a lot about that on the air over the course of today. Yeah. So embers blowing, catching something, you know, that's near your house on fire, like a pile of wood, catching your deck on fire, catching a plant on fire, and then that igniting your house. That's a big risk. Also, in terms of like being able to get out of those areas, I mean, if you've ever spent time in the Palisades or a lot of these foothill communities, they're often one way in, one way out neighborhoods with maybe like an emergency only road with a gate. And so evacuating from these places can be pretty scary, especially when you don't have a lot of notice.
I remember when I went out to Malibu after one of the fires. I mean, it's PCH. That's it. That's the only road up and out of that place. It's frightening how closed off people can be. But still, I mean, we've seen it, Emily, people build and rebuild. The big question is why? So why do we keep doing this?
Well, so if you kind of follow the money with some of these developments, so the people that approve new housing developments are often at the county or city level. And developers frequently donate to their reelection campaigns. Developers also know that their developments will generate a lot of tax revenue for counties and for cities, like for schools. You know, but it's interesting because the counties and cities don't often pay for the cost of firefighting. Oftentimes, if there is a county fire department, they'll get reimbursed for the cost of firefighting from the federal government. So it's called a moral hazard. The people taking the risk to approve these new developments aren't the ones paying the cost of protecting them when the fires start.
What a name, the moral hazard.
The moral hazard. Yeah. It's an economics term, yeah.
Now, you've spoken with developers who build huge sprawling communities in areas that have already been identified as high fire severity zones. What do they say in defense of these moves?
Well, so I talked to a developer last year in Orange County who was building almost 400 new luxury homes in a very high fire risk area. And he just kind of fundamentally disagreed with the idea that certain areas should be off limits, that they're too dangerous to build. He says, you know, if his houses meet all state and local requirements for fire-resistant construction, if they have the proper ratio of evacuation routes to new residents, then he should be able to build because, like we said, those are very desirable areas. Houses in these areas often are very expensive. They're profitable to build. And, you know, a lot of the local requirements require things like having defensible space around your house, maybe having like sprinklers in your attic, using certain fire resistant materials for your roof. And if you meet those things, this developer argues, you know, you should be able to build.
Like 5 feet around your house, all that, you know, like give. Yeah, you mentioned defensible space, actually giving firefighters space too to work because sometimes they get clogged up as well.
Right. Well, I think defensible space is both having an area around your house where there isn't anything flammable, and also, like you said, making sure firefighters can get in there to defend your house.
One more thing, Emily, really quick. What are the chances that someday in the future, the county or the state steps in and says, no, can't build in these areas anymore, way too dangerous?
I just don't think that's going to happen. I mean, it's so kind of un-American to imagine being told this area is too dangerous for you to build. It seems to me more likely that there would be like a market forcing. So maybe it becomes impossible to get insurance in these areas. Hmm. Or maybe there's some kind of fire mitigation fee you have to pay to build in one of these areas that becomes really expensive. That seems more likely to me as something that would discourage development. I think Governor Newsom said earlier this year he didn't want to just flat out ban it. So maybe we'll just see it fall out of favor as it gets too risky and expensive.
That's KPCC Environment Reporter Emily Guerin. Emily, thanks a lot.
Thanks, A.
All right, coming up, we've been talking about people and structures a lot the last few hours. What about critters? What about our friends with four legs that can't yell for help and that need our help? We're going to find out what we do for them in these cases of fire when Take 2 continue. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm A. Martinez. The Saddle Ridge Fire is an area represented by L.A. County Supervisor Catherine Barger. So we've asked her to join us to explain what she's most concerned about right now. Supervisor, welcome back to Take 2.
Well, I mean, the timing is perfect in terms of what I'm most concerned about. I'm out here at the command post, and I'm concerned about getting accurate information out to the public as it relates to areas of evacuation, where they can go, where they can take large animals, and, you know, the freeways that are closed, because we've got a lot of individuals, a lot of chiefs out here, and we want to make sure we get one message going forward as it relates to people impacted by this fire.
How much of a problem has that been going back to yesterday all through today, messaging, getting people the right information, the most accurate and up-to-date information?
Well, I think we've corrected it. Obviously, this has been United Command right now. I mean, it was LA City Fire was the lead at the beginning, and now they're United Command. So we are designating, one point of contact. And I've talked to LA County Fire about putting that on their webpage so that we've got consistent information. And if people want to get any of that, it's fire.lacounty.gov.
How's your office preparing for the worst case scenario, that the winds blow toward the city? Right now, they're up in that Porter Ranch area where there's not city, but there's still things that are going to catch fire and burn.
Well, it's adjacent to the county, unincorporated area. Obviously, we're focused right now on the ridge moving toward Santa Clarita. The initial reports were that the wind was going to shift and it could possibly move in that direction. We had a spot fire in Sierra Highway that jumped, but they got that out. We've got fixed-wing aircraft dropping fire repellent down on the ridge there to do a break. So I have to say, I've been talking to the fire, both LA City, LA County, and I have to say that they have a total focus on really addressing moving forward with this fire and ensuring that it does not impact Santa Clarita. And then I talked to Supervisor Long in Ventura County. They're preparing up in Simi Valley with evacuation locations, and our hope is it does not cross the county line into Ventura.
One more thing, Supervisor. When these things happen, we see all of you on TV saying all the right things and trying to be helpful, but this is your area. How does it make you feel to see what this area, your constituents, the people that vote for you and that you answer to going through this?
Oh, it's horrible. I mean, any tragedy, whether it's in my district or, with the Woolsey Fire, when I was watching what was going on with people that are not my constituents, politics aside, this is about people, and you don't want to see people's lives impacted. And 25 structures lost, that's 25 families that have been impacted by this fire. You can't help but kind of take a step back and say, this is just a horrible situation. And then one death associated with the fire. It's horrible, but the great part about this is that Senator Dianne Feinstein, I talked to her today. She is totally engaged with this and ready to assist us in any way possible. Gavin Newsom, the Governor Newsom, FEMA, thank the president for agreeing that we're going to move forward with FEMA. We are doing everything we can, and as elected and someone who represents this area, we are united in making sure that those impacted are taken care of.
That's LA County Supervisor Catherine Barger. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And it isn't just people who are displaced by fire. Domestic and large animals also being impacted by the fires in Porter Ranch, Granada Hills, and Sylmar. On the line, we have some first responders to these types of animal emergencies. First up, we have Tori Lee, a supervisor with Los Angeles Animal Services. She's assisting with relief at Hanson Dam. Tori, thanks for taking the time.
Thank you.
So, Tori, what's a priority number one for you and your teams right now?
Our priority is safety and organization so that in the middle of the chaos of things, we can run swiftly and smoothly.
Describe the conditions on the ground in your area. What are you seeing? What are you smelling? Is it smoky for you right now over there?
It's not too bad right now. all the animals that are coming in are getting food and water and shelter, and we'll take all the animals until full capacity is reached. Other than that, other arrangements will be made when we're full.
How stressed are the animals, and how can you tell? What are you seeing in them?
They sway back and forth. They pound at the doors. But, I mean, for the most part, right now, everybody seems kind of content.
So what actively is being done to get these animals to safety? And actually, where are they going? For most of them, actually.
The large animals right now are being taken in at Hampton Dam, where I'm at. And the smaller animals are being taken to our East Valley shelter in Van Nuys and our West Valley shelter in Chatsworth.
Now, Tori, you work with a number of volunteers. How are citizens getting involved, everyday people?
The donations are coming in and helping hands from many volunteers, which is greatly appreciated. Right now, we're in desperate need of some shavings for the stalls, and feed for the horses is always appreciated.
All right, that's Tori Lee, supervisor with LA Animal Services, on site for the Saddle Ridge Fire. Tori, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
And now we turn to another animal welfare group. Brad Samuelson is co-founder of the nonprofit Operation Blankets of Love. He's also been helping keeping animals safe and escaping different fires. Brad, thanks a lot for joining us.
Hi, thank you very much.
Now, what services is your organization providing?
Well, Operation Blankets of Love is an animal welfare and emergency relief organization in California. We actually take care of rescues all the way from Mexico all the way up to Canada. We provide pet food, blankets, towels, leashes, collars to rescues and shelters throughout the state and beyond. And we also deal with a lot of organizations that help the homeless with their pets. And then we go into schools and teach kids pet care and pet education. So this is a very busy animal welfare and emergency nonprofit organization.
Brad, what kind of shape are some of the animals that are already in your care right now?
Well, actually, here's what we do. We are a service provider for the Red Cross, and therefore, when there's disasters like what's been going on here, like Robert, or even the Ridgecrest district, we're in the go mode to pack up the vans with food, blankets, towels, collars for those folks that have been displaced.
Mm-hmm.
So, like Ridgecrest, we sent probably several thousand pounds of supplies. Today, we've been shuttling back and forth between the Granada Hills, Northridge, and Chatsworth Red Cross evacuation centers, bringing all those supplies. And also, between 12 a.m. and 2:30 a.m., we were busy evacuating animals from a local sanctuary. And then I had to go back there today and evacuate. There were evacuated horses and potbelly pigs and all sorts of other.
Brad, sorry to interrupt. Your phone is starting to go in and out a little bit, but thanks for coming on. That's Brad Samuelson of Operation Blankets of Love, a nonprofit providing relief to homeless and stranded animals. Brad, thanks a lot. A lot of you have written us about the fires burning and have asked, how can we help? Well, earlier you heard from animal welfare that food is appreciated, but when it comes to humans, this is what organizations such as the Red Cross and Goodwill have told us. They prefer that your donations come in cash and not physical objects, because that takes a lot of time to sort and process. A spokesperson from Operation USA says, items that are used, collected, are very hard to actually ship and distribute, and more often than not, they create a burden and are warehoused or trashed rather than delivered to where they might be needed. In the wake of fires, cash will be the best way to help those who are impacted. So there you go. Thanks to all of you out there who are willing to help. And don't forget, keep it tuned right here to KPCC all day long for coverage of all the fires. If you can't get us on the radio, make sure you get us on the app or online, kpcc.org.